earlier stage companies, when they think about product market fit, they think about making a customer happy, a little bit like what you were just talking about. And they take that signal that they're getting from the market as, you know, a signal that they've achieved some level of product market fit. And I think that's true. That's probably true. The companies that we're investing in, I would say maybe, let's say the next stage of that product market fit is this transition to what I think of as the difference between being driven by a customer or a single group of customers versus sort of a repeatable product that you can sell essentially the same product over and over and over again.
Welcome to the Unicorn Bakery. My name is Fabian Tausch, and today we will have a look at General Atlantic's recipe for success. Chuck Feeney founded General Atlantic to maximize his wealth after he sold his company duty-free for $1 billion back before the 2000s, but there's a twist to the story. He wanted to give away all the money he makes with that, and in total, this accumulated to more than $8 billion over time. Chuck Feeney is the role model for the Founders Pledge that many people like Warren Buffett or Bill Gates and many more committed to. And Warren Buffett once said, "Chuck's been the model for us all. If you have the right heroes in life, you're 90% of the way home." Chuck Feeney's a good hero to have. And General Atlantic grew faster than they could give away the money at some point. I have to smile a bit because I just think it's awesome. So he created the Atlantic Philanthropies to separate the branches. And today General Atlantic is investing in growth startups and is a rolling fund structure and one of the most iconic investor brands out there. Today's guest is Corey Eaves, and Corey is an operating partner at GA and has worked there for over 13 years and was a CTO at several companies before. A huge thank you to Flixbus founder Daniel Krauss for putting us in touch to make this episode possible. Corey, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Fabian. Great to be on the Unicorn Bakery. Look forward to our discussion today. Yeah.
I told you when we first met that I, by accident, heard a podcast about a completely different company and then stumbled upon the story of Chuck Feeney on how he sold his company duty-free and then founded GA to maximize profits and then also give it all away. And it's just ridiculous because I never thought about it before listening to this podcast, which was, in my opinion, the acquired podcast on LVMH, for everybody wondering. And I just wanted to know how much of this DNA is still left. Like, how is GA currently handling the, I don't want to call it burden, but the DNA that was injected during the first years and still, like, how much or how do you live by that DNA today?
Yeah, that's great. Well, you told the story, Fabian, about, you know, how the firm was founded. And I would say it's very much, you know, the groundwork that Chuck laid when the firm was put together almost 45 years ago is still a really big part of the culture at GA. You know, a couple of the things that Chuck really held as valuable was, first of all, helping entrepreneurs like himself. Just as he was an entrepreneur, he wanted to help other entrepreneurs fund and grow their business. And that is really, you know, like a core part of what we do, you know, very much today. I think the other thing that maybe is still a hallmark for us is that Chuck really wanted a culture of collegiality and respect and collaboration. And that, again, I think is kind of one of the big hallmarks. We really think of ourselves as partners with entrepreneurs and partners with our investors to, you know, help them grow and scale businesses. And it just maybe the last thing is that GA has really a very strong culture around philanthropy too. So we encourage all of our employees, you know, our senior employees right down to our most junior employees to give back, to, you know, participate in things they care about and they're passionate about. The firm's very supportive of that and provides time and funding for all of the employees to go do that. So the firm has changed a lot over the, you know, 45 years that we've been around, but some of those hallmarks that Chuck laid down are very much still part of the firm. So it's great.
Tell us a bit more about the firm. Like you said, it changed much and there are a lot of people working there by now. So how large is GA by today?
Yeah. So the firm has grown a lot. We really started though doing growth equity investing, and the kind of simple way to think about growth equity investing, probably for a lot of your listeners, is, you know, the kind of stages after venture. So our investments have really focused on helping companies grow and scale post that venture stage. More traditional private equity, the larger buyouts type of things are really not where we started or really what our hallmark is. So that's kind of the focus that we have. The firm for many years focused exclusively on technology. So we were investing in the early days on hardware and software companies. But these days we've branched out and we cover a lot of industries like consumer and financial services. Even in the industries that we cover, though, we tend to have a very strong technology lens. So we're looking for businesses that use technology in some important way for their business model. And then maybe the last thing I would highlight is really the global nature of GA. So as the firm has grown and scaled, we were one of the first firms to open offices and start doing investments in India, in China, in Brazil. And if you look at our investments today, more than half of our investments are outside the U.S. and they're with that global footprint. So if you put all that together, a focus on technology, a focus on growth, and a global footprint, the firm today, just in terms of size, we manage north of $70 billion in assets and have several hundred employees around the world who focus on our investing program. Yep. It's a little thumbnail sketch on GA.
That's so crazy. I think it makes sense to ask about the fine line between venture and growth equity, because it's not that trivial to say, hey, it's A, B, or C, and then you're absolutely certain that it's growth equity rather than venture. So how do you define the line between venture and growth equity? When is growth equity the right fundraising or, let's say, capital source for startups?
Yeah, it's a great question, Fabian, and you're right. It's not a there's not a bright line, let's say, between venture investing and growth equity investing. You know, one of the ways we think about it is the type of risk that GA is taking in these investments. And you know, in the early stages of a business, venture and seed stages of a business, there is a lot of risk around just the ability of the company to build a product or service, and then trying to fine tune the product market fit of that service. The distinction I would make in the growth equity phase of investing is a lot of those issues are typically worked out. Like the company is closing in or has a good product market fit. And the risk we're taking then is about helping the company actually grow and scale, largely grow their footprint, grow their customer base, grow their geographies over time. It's execution risk maybe versus product risk is maybe one way to sort of think about the difference between those things. Another lens, or kind of maybe another way to think about it, is by the size of the funding. And this maybe translates again for entrepreneurs a little better. You know, the smaller end of our investments would be, let's say, in the $30 to $50 million range and scaling up from there. And just based on that size, you can tell that's, you know, far beyond the typical size of typical venture investments, seed investments. Does that make sense?
Hopefully that makes sense. Do you have an upper limit for your investments as an initial ticket?
There's no practical limit. You know, our larger investments would be several hundred million dollars. You know, it would just depend on the business. There's, for companies who are raising money at the size that we deal with, the generally the upper limit is not really a problem for us. Yeah.
It sounds so crazy when you sit there and say, hey, we could do a lot of money as an initial ticket. It sounds so surreal. So talking about so much money, does it feel that surreal when you decide to invest, let's say, several hundred millions in a venture?
Well, surreal is probably not the right word. It's very, you know, thoughtful and considered on our part. But it really just comes down to what the company needs, you know, to grow and scale the business. And that's kind of what the governor is. Our deals have grown over time as the firm, as GA itself has scaled and grown. It's given us an ability to do larger deals. It's also given us ability, I think, to invest multiple times over the life of a company. So if a company comes to us when they're small and maybe needs a relatively small amount of capital, oftentimes we can provide multiple rounds of funding for them that can take them all the way to, you know, perhaps an IPO or something, you know, out the other end. So yeah, the investment size is usually something we focus on more on the lower end. And to be honest, one of the things that we're often trying to do is find investments that are big enough, you know, is to find investments where we can put a sizable amount of capital to work to help grow and scale a business is one of the things we spend a lot of time kind of thinking about at GA.
How does the return expectation from a growth equity investment differ from a venture investment?
Yeah. The way I would say it differs is it's a narrower risk window is maybe one way to think about it, which is to say, you know, we would focus on getting, you know, returns in the, you know, teens and 20s as a consistent set of returns for the investment. The venture world tends to have a wider dispersion of investments. When they make investments, the return expectation would be that they would have a handful of investments that would do exceptionally well, and then a handful of investments that may be in the middle, and then often some investments in that world that don't do very well. And that sort of averages out to a certain performance. In the growth equity world, it's a much tighter band. So we tend to not have things that, you know, are kind of moonshot type, you know, investments. We generally try and avoid those things, have good, consistent, high returns. But we also really try and avoid binary bets that cause the low end, which is investments that would, you know, go to zero or have really poor returns. So that's a little how we sort of think about the return window for expectations.
And I think one additional question until I finally ask what kind of startups you're actually looking at. But before, you said you look for product market fit and try to de-risk as much as possible in like if product market fit is there or not. And what I see nowadays is that like every investor as early as possible talks about product market fit.
Interesting.
And I think there are different stages of product market fit. So
yep.
It's definitely completely different from the seed indicators of product market fit. So it would be very helpful if you could define how you at GA think about product market fit for your stage.
Yeah. Well, Fabian, before I answer that, tell me a little I'm not as familiar as you might be about seed and venture investors. Give me a little sense of what they think about when they think about product market fit.
I think they look about the first indications of very well or very good customer feedback, first indications of, okay, people want to buy it and tend to love the product, and try to find indicators for product market fit. And when they think about a product market fit fully, they're like, yeah, now we have dozens, hundreds, thousands of people using the product and loving the product. But I think it definitely differs from I need 50 to 100 million or 200 million to invest into my startup and grow from there versus, okay, now I have the feeling of I've found the right messaging for the market that I'm serving. And I think that differs completely in at least my opinion.
Yeah, that's helpful. Yeah, that's really helpful. I the way I think about it a little bit is, you know, I think a lot of our companies are, you know, what I see is that earlier stage companies, when they think about product market fit, they think about making a customer happy, a little bit like what you were just talking about. And they take that signal that they're getting, you know, from the market as, you know, a signal that they've achieved some level of product market fit. And I think that's true. That's probably true. The companies that we're investing in, I would say maybe, let's say the next stage of that product market fit is this transition to what I think of as the difference between being driven by a customer or a single group of customers versus sort of a repeatable product that you can sell essentially the same product over and over and over again. And I talk about this with our companies often about going from being project-based to being product-based. And if you know what I mean there, like it would be, it's possible to make a lot of customers happy by selling a highly customized product that's specific for almost each individual customers. And a lot of early companies do that. They should do that. Like, that's how they win customers. That's how they get feedback. But ultimately, they sort of need to transition to being able to listen to a broad group of customers and then distill that down to a single product or service or a group of product and services, and then be able to sell that over and over and over again. That transition is really, like, when we think about product market fit, that's sort of the hurdle, let's say, that a lot of our companies are either about to get over or just getting over by the time that we invest. And the reason that's so important is because that's what drives scale. If companies are, you know, if their product is essentially customized for each individual customer, it's really hard to get that to scale up and to get efficiencies on it. So that's maybe one way to think about it. The other way I would say to think about it is we look at the gross margins or the economics of this. And, you know, it's not enough to scale a company to just get somebody to buy it. If you sell something at the right price, most people will sort of buy anything. And so the idea is, can you sell it at a price on a unit basis that actually, you know, generates margin and generates income for the business? And so that's a question largely about, you know, gross margin and efficiency in the, you know, production and delivery of the product or service. And so that's maybe, I don't know if that makes sense, but that gives a little bit of a lens of kind of how we start to think a little bit more about a product market.
I have two angles to ask right now. The first is on the margin side. I know that there are so many different verticals and so many different business models, but what does a healthy margin look like for you so that you're like, okay, for this business model, it makes sense to think this further?
Yeah. Yeah, I think the answer to that question, Fabian, depends entirely on the business model. We spend a lot of time at GA thinking about the different types of business models that are out there. When we think about those business models, that's going to drive the set of metrics and the margin expectations for the business. And just to throw out a couple of examples, you know, if you're a, let's say, a more traditional enterprise software business, you know, there should be margins there in the 80s or 90s, for example. You know, if you're a transaction business, like a business that is, you know, Square or somebody like that, you know, those are margins where there's very high volumes, but the take rate in those businesses might be 1-3% or something like that. So, you know, I think the margin expectations just entirely are based on, you know, kind of what the business model in the market would be going into it. It's really hard to generalize those. The business model question is, it's a really important one, and it's a fundamental one of the kind of three or four core things that we look for in a new investment. One of the most important ones that we think about is the type of business model in the business.
I have the feeling, and I'm not sure if you have the same, but that a lot of founders think, oh yeah, we need this business, and never even think if it's mathematically a good idea to do it, like taking out a napkin, doing a few mathematics and like, okay, I have this cost and I have this revenue potential or per customer. So can I even, if I scale it, be profitable? And if you're not using a napkin, you could also do it in Excel, but like figuring out, is it actually a good business even when I scale it, and what are my assumptions? And I have the feeling that a lot of founders, especially the ones that started in 2020, 2021, because it was often like, it was obviously a hype cycle, often don't really understand their own business case.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I think that's very true. And, you know, we've seen that in other times when the market was at these sort of peaks in volumes as well. You know, I can think back to one business that we looked at maybe in the last bubble, let's say, and it was an e-commerce business. And, you know, at a gross level, they were essentially selling hard physical goods at a loss on a unit basis. And, you know, all their fundraising deck was talking about, you know, revenue growth and market share growth and, you know, the phenomenal scaling that the businesses had. But, you know, that's like selling dollar bills for 50 cents. It's pretty easy to make that work. And that was just a business that, you know, even when it scaled, was not going to ever be a viable business going forward. So needless to say, that's when we passed on. That was not one that we invested in. But I think you're right. I think just taking the time to think about that is really important. The risk of using some buzzwords, you know, we talk about that as the unit economic model, you know, which is like being really clear if just on a single customer basis, what are the economics for that? Another way to think about it is, you know, we have several businesses in healthcare, for example, which are based around physical locations, physical centers to see patients. And, you know, you can do the same sort of modeling on a per location basis. You know, if I invest a certain amount of capital in a business to, you know, build a building and open a center and hire employees, there's typically a J curve of, you know, when that particular location starts to be profitable. And being able as an entrepreneur to really understand that and communicate that clearly, I think is super important. And then the, you know, profitability levers of the business become just a function of how many of those clinics, you know, they might open over time, for example. But being able to disaggregate that to a per clinic basis is really important.
I also think it's a very important differentiation, and I always want to highlight, we're not talking about being profitable super early. We're talking about figuring out if I can build what I want to build profitably so that I know at some point this clinic earns money and I know that I have to invest first because a clinic doesn't come up from nowhere. But I know, let's say, just as an example, after 4, 5, or 10, 12, 15 years, it might become profitable and I know it because I've done it. And then now I know that I can start one clinic after another. And it's more on a, can I prove that it's something that may work? And at some point cover all the expenses we have for team, for marketing, for setup costs, etc. And I think that's something that founders often get wrong when they get asked about profitability or a path to profitability early on, that they think, oh, why should I like try to do everything profitable from day one? And it's more about proving that the economics might work.
Yes, very well said. I think you described that exactly right. And to just take that one step further, you know, then the question of when you eventually do become profitable, to stick with our clinic example, really is all about the pace and timing of opening clinics. So to use a simple example, if you opened, you know, 5 clinics and then stopped and didn't open any more clinics, within a year or two, the business would be profitable, but it would essentially stop growing. If you just kept opening more and more clinics, the business may be continue to be unprofitable for some long period because you're funding those new clinic openings, but at least you can prove that the early clinics have been able to achieve profitability. So I think that's exactly the right way to think about it. Yeah.
I have one topic that I want to go back to because you talked about enterprise software, and then also that you said at some point you need to find something that's not too customized. You have to build a product and not project for the customer. I think that's one of the hardest transformations ever, because at least from my perspective, because it also feels that companies like SAP, and it's a German example, me as a German person, I have to bring that one up. They still have like so many companies doing implementation services to make the software work inside of other organizations. So it's always an example where people are like, yeah, but I'm not sure how much, like you can customize everything. So pretty much. So where's the fine line here? Let's stick to enterprise software, because otherwise it will get too complicated. But a lot of enterprise founders have a huge problem of like building a product instead of a project and differentiating properly what is like, what counts as a project, what counts as an actual product, because it feels like, yeah, an enterprise customer who's, let's say, paying $1 million a year always feels like he or she needs some customization.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, I think you're right, Fabian. I think this is one of the most difficult transitions for companies to go through. I'm, you know, an engineer and a technologist by background, so I'm probably, I spend a lot of my time just thinking about this and working exactly with our companies on this exact point. Look, I don't think it's wrong to start with a highly customer-focused organization where things are customized. That's normal. That's where companies should start. That's where most do start, because I think that's where you experiment. That's where you figure out needs. That's where you can generate revenue and just get the company, you know, going and off the launch pad. I think to scale it though, you do have to sort of make this transition. And you know, one of the starting points, just from a product or technology perspective, is, you know, designing the product early on so that the product itself can be configured as much as possible. You know, trying to set, you know, things that can be done in settings or with configuration or scripting versus having to be entirely customized by code. A lot of the companies we see who, you know, have that mindset from day one, find this transition, you know, let's say a little bit easier. Another thing that sort of tends to work here a little bit that you touched on with the SAP example, is sometimes finding third parties, you know, kind of building a network of implementation partners or third-party service companies. Sometimes some of the big integration, you know, big four type integration firms can be helpful. That can be another way to do this. You know, maybe just the other thing, kind of the third quick thing I might add on this front is, I think having people at the business who bring this experience, largely, you know, product management and engineering people, can also be a real accelerant to helping companies go through this. You know, this is a common transition. And if you've got people in the product organization or the technology organization who've been through it before, I think they can, you know, really kind of jumpstart this and help companies get through this more quickly.
I think it's super helpful for some founders to hear that there are different ways to do that, and also implementation partners or also productizing more, like that there are different ways of doing it. And I think you have to figure out what is the right one for your company.
Yeah. I think the other thing, just maybe one other quick thought, Fabian, is I think what happens often too as companies go through this is that if they start to grow and scale and they look at some of those early customers, often they'll find that those early customers are not as profitable as they might expect. And so one of the things that companies typically have to go through, you know, like a painful part of this transition is really being disciplined and looking at the profitability that they're getting by customer. And sometimes also might have to, let's say, almost fire some of their customers as they go through this transition to help get over this. Not unusual.
I think that's a super interesting addition. One question, I think it summarizes a lot that we talked about, but when you want to summarize and describe what kind of companies you're looking for to invest in, how would you describe your targets?
Yeah. So I would say I tried to think of a sort of a catchy way to think about this, and I'll offer up maybe four M's that we think about. So the first is market. You know, we try and think about the total market size. Again, at the risk of using some of the buzzwords, it's, you know, total available market, service available market, service obtainable market. You know, it's looking at, if the company were to scale and win significant market share, what would that look like? So we spend a lot of time, you know, thinking about that. The second is model, business model. We touched on this earlier, but there are lots of different business models, transaction business models, there's subscription business models, SaaS business models. And the business model of the companies that we look at is one of the things that we spend a lot of time thinking about. Different business models are just inherently more attractive or less attractive than others. Business models that are resilient through economic cycles are better. Business models that have recurring revenue are better. Some business models demonstrate network effects, you know, strong or weak network effects. Those are better business models. So we look a lot and think a lot about what is the business model that the companies constructed around. The third is management. You know, we by the time we invest, we would like to see a management team, a CEO and a top management team that's largely filled out. It doesn't have to be perfect, and there can be an open seat or two, but there should be the basics of a management team that's in place. Certainly a CEO, we want to back a strong CEO. CFO is really important. CIO or CTO, like the technology leader and the product leader and head of sales. Again, not every one of those has to be perfect or filled, but I think that's one of the things that we would, you know, spend time thinking about. And then the last one is just kind of looking at, as we talked about a minute ago, margins. Like, what is the economic model of the business? And can they sort of prove that the economics, when they get to a certain scale, will actually achieve profitability? Those are the most important ones. We look at many other things, the dynamics around the deal and competition and other things. But if it's got management, a business model, a market, and margins, those would be the basic things that we would think about for a new investment.
When you talk about dynamics, do you mean that it's also, if you see that other growth investors are also interested, that you then have, then you then have the feeling of, okay, we have to move faster? Like, is it that what you mean, that it is the same as in an earlier stage, that the more competition, the more fear of missing out comes up with the investors, and the faster you feel like you have to move?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say it about the speed that we need to move at, but I will say that, you know, when we're considering an investment, you know, there the dynamics around the investment are part of, you know, the actual investment process is part of what we consider. There are some companies that, you know, go into that investment process and they're just 100% about, you know, an economic decision about maximizing price. And I think other businesses are more thoughtful. They're trying to choose a long-term partner. They're trying to evaluate what the partner can bring to the table besides only capital. You know, in those sorts of situations, I think we approach those things differently than we do, let's say, in just a strict auction, you know, where the company's trying to maximize price. So yes, I mean, we do think about what are the dynamics around a particular, you know, investment.
When you talk about bringing stuff to the table, and I think that's what every investor has to do, especially during this stage, what are the typical areas that you work on with the companies? Because it sounds like they're obviously at a certain level where they, of course, need cash to accelerate or tolerate their growth rates further. At the same time, no business is perfect. So what are the typical areas that such growth businesses have to work on after an investment?
Sure. Yeah. Well, look, I mean, I think it's capital is kind of the starting point. And obviously, as we touched on earlier, we can provide funding, you know, often multiple rounds of funding for a company over time. But beyond the funding, we have a whole series of value-added capabilities that we offer up as a menu to our portfolio companies. And it's things like really deep industry experience that we bring from the firm. Our firm is very much organized around industry sectors. And so if we're investing in healthcare or financial services, our depth of our knowledge and network there is a really important part of what we can bring. Beyond that, we bring expertise around human capital, helping companies evaluate their team and hire and fill out their management team and help drive organizational effectiveness. We have capabilities around helping companies fine-tune their go-to-market capabilities. How are they organized from a selling perspective? We have a digital marketing team, data science team, a team that can help companies think about pricing. So we've got a relatively large team at GA that's a set of resources that our portfolio companies can sort of call on to help them, you know, grow and scale the business. What we very much do when we invest at GA early on is we sit down with the management team together collaboratively and sort of work out, okay, how can we best help you? What are the things you most need to scale and grow the company? And then if we have those resources inside of GA, we'll organize a way to bring those to the company, you know, over time. Sometimes they need resources that we don't have at GA. Often we can bring in third parties to help with that as well. And that process right up front as part of the investment is part of what we bring to bear. So that's a little bit how we approach it and think about it.
I can imagine that it's not the first meeting where I, as a founder, undress myself and say, hey, that's what we have to work on at the company, because it feels like, hey, I can't tell about all the problems and areas we can work on and have to work on. So how long does a typical process or due diligence take until you say, okay, that's a partnership we want to make from both sides?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a process of getting to know each other on both sides. I would say, you know, maybe not the very first meeting is the right place for that, but early on, you know, I think entrepreneurs who are, you know, aware themselves of where they need help, I think is a really important first step. And, you know, being able to say like, okay, you know, we're raising this fund, you know, we're raising this round of funding because, you know, we feel like we've got a product here, but we really think that our product could be applicable in another country, let's say, and we're looking for a partner who can help us expand into that country, I think is a totally fair thing to say, you know, as an entrepreneur. And I think hearing that at GA, we would be excited about that because I think we would see that as something that says, yes, okay, we can help, you know, with something like that. You're right, Fabian, that like you have to be thoughtful. You don't want to do this maybe, let's say, on the first date, but, you know, as we get to know each other a little bit, I think just being open and honest about what the company needs to grow and scale can help us determine whether we can help with something like that.
To sum it up in a fun way, you also, as a founder, have to know how to feed your investor the right dish at the right time, the right course at the right time, so that they also want to talk this further and take this further to then decide, hey, we partner together and we both see that there are growth areas where we can work together.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's well said.
And I can imagine that for many companies, IPOs will be the next step, like the goal, and for others it's exits. At some point, I can imagine, because not every company can IPO. So how is it already, like, how do you talk with founders about how they perceive their goals and visions, like where they want to go, and how much they already thought about what their next steps will be, and also a few years down the road? You said a partnership can be 5 to 7 years. I think it's more the average time that you mentioned. There will be extremes in both ways, but so how do you talk with founders about vision?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think, you know, maybe as a starting point, I'd say we tend to not maybe focus on this as the most important topic. Like, a little bit of our philosophy at GA is, you know, that if we build a great company with a great management team, that there will be multiple options for exit down the road. So it would be pretty rare that we would go into a company, let's say on day one, with a vision that said, okay, 5 years from now, we're going to sell the company here. Like, we just don't tend to really think about it in that way. I'd say some businesses, some industries, some countries lend themselves maybe better one way or the other. You know, in this market, obviously, with the IPO market largely closed, you know, if you just looked at our announcements in the last 6 months, let's say, even the last month, it's been almost exclusively exits on our side by sales to strategic buyers. At some point, the IPO market will open back up, hopefully maybe this fall, we'll see. You know, we might start to see more IPOs again, but that's a little bit about how we think about it. It's an important thing for an entrepreneur to consider. On both of those scenarios, you know, when you get to that endpoint, whether it's a sale or an IPO at the end, the CEO and the whole management team really are kind of signing up for another chapter, let's say, in the business. And so I think having good alignment with management about, you know, do they want to do that? What is their timing? You know, what are their preferences? I think that's a conversation that, you know, it's important to have, and we try and have that, you know, relatively early on in the investment. So, yeah.
Interesting, because at the point that you're investing, you definitely have so much more information than in like pre-seed, seed, or Series A stage, so that you also can see that the vision is not like completely irrelevant, but it's also not like the most important part. Because in an early stage, I have to sell you a lot on my vision, because I don't have the data to back up that the model works. I have a lot of hypotheses. So it's interesting to see how it changes, and also important to understand as a founder how the things that I have to look at when I'm running my business change. I have to look at the data. I have to assess my own business model with that and try to figure out what is possible and what isn't, and how to adapt based on that. So I think that's a super important part for a lot of founders. Even well, we all know that it's super, super hard to get to the stage at all. So it's not that like every company that starts gets to that stage, even when it felt that way in 2020, 2021, even then it was not the case.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's right. And that's exactly right. And I think you're completely right too, Fabian, that, you know, the stage of our companies are at, you know, I see this in the maturity of our companies from the, you know, day we invest to 5 or 6 years later when we, you know, sell the business. As I work with our entrepreneurs and our companies, I see them evolve and grow very much through this. And one of the main ways that they change is they become much, much more driven by the data and the performance of the business. You know, they're setting annual and quarterly objectives. They're using OKRs to sort of manage their teams. They're paying, you know, very close attention to metrics around customers and retention and satisfaction and so on. And that's a very, very typical journey over the life of the companies that we invest in.
You quickly talked about the current market and the IPO window. So let's quickly assess the market here. I think a few thoughts would be good to hear for a lot of people out there, even when we don't have to make projections for the future, because it's always hard. But like, let's start with the current market of like growth fundraising or growth investing. What is your take? Like, how is it currently behaving? How much has it slowed down from the peaks? How many deals are you maybe doing compared to back in 2021? So that just that founders get a feeling what's currently happening.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so the current state of the market is, as I'm sure most of your, you know, listeners will know, is very, very different. Our pace has slowed down for sure, maybe less than half of what we were doing before. What you typically see is that the private markets, the valuations in the private markets lag the public markets by some period, 3 months, 6 months, a year. You know, with the correction that had happened in the public markets more than a year ago, I think you're just now in the very early stages of starting to see some of that correction trickle through, let's say, into the private markets. So, we have done investments this year. I think entrepreneurs have kind of begun to reset a little bit, maybe their expectations on value and getting those things done. The public markets and the IPO market in particular is still closed. You know, your guess is as good as mine. I'm not an economist, but, you know, I think our consensus is that maybe in this fall we'll start to see that open up a little bit. I do think we're sort of bracing for a recession, at least in the U.S., and the hope maybe here at GA is that it won't be too deep. I think we are very much expecting that general economic conditions will continue to be challenging for the foreseeable future.
Thanks for sharing. I will not ask about projections because I don't think it makes too much sense like to go deeper on that right now.
Yeah, I'm not sure I could offer anything unique on that front anyway, so...
I know there's also something that people tend to like, yeah, let's rather not do it. I might not like what I said a month ago or stuff. So therefore, but you said it slowed down 50%. So to get a like an understanding what that means, how many deals are you making a year?
I hesitate to put a specific number on the deals that we would make, but because it really depends. We have many different teams at GA across different sectors and geographies, and they all have their own sort of pace of deals. So it's a little tough to generalize the actual number of investments. But as a general rule, think of it about half the pace that we might have done before.
But we can ask, how many deals have you done in 2021? That should be an absolute number.
I don't know the number off the top of my head.
Is it more like 10? Is it more like 100? Is it more like 500? Just to get a general understanding, it's super hard for others to know.
Yeah, I would say in general, in the, you know, 20 to 50 range would be the number of deals maybe that we would do. Yeah.
Sorry for pinning you down. I just think it's super helpful.
Yep.
Have to laugh a bit. But... One question further, like going away from the numbers, but I think it's helpful. Let's say you want to pick 20 to 50, to just quickly stick with the number, but ventures, that means you have to look at a lot more companies. So how are you at GA assessing to monitor the market and to figure out and identify who you want to talk to first?
Yeah. So we do this largely by industry. So a lot of GA is organized specifically by industry group. Little more so in the U.S. than outside the U.S., but generally speaking, we're very strongly organized at GA by sector, industry sector. And each one of those sectors at GA sort of has as a, let's say, a core responsibility of that team to monitor the market and pay attention to companies that are in the space. And so they're, through our own, you know, teams here at GA, they're doing that kind of all day, every day. They're, you know, scanning the news, talking to entrepreneurs, talking to banks, going to conferences, reading about research in the space, talking to consultants. I mean, they're doing all those things to try and keep their, you know, fingers, let's say, on the pulse of all the different companies that are out there. Our teams very much try to meet companies months or years even before they need to raise capital. That's how they get to know the entrepreneurs. That's how they get smarter about the market. And so it's actually pretty easy to get connected with GA, I think. You know, we're always happy to talk to an entrepreneur, always happy to talk to a company. And if one of our employees doesn't find the company themselves, usually our front door, let's say, is pretty wide open to come in and have a conversation with us. So yeah, it's something we spend a lot of time on, and I think we do a really good job of just trying to keep an eye on kind of what's out there from a market perspective.
So you get to know the companies quite early. You then, let's say, monitor them. And whenever you get a signal that they're fundraising for their growth round, you already know the company and want to know if you want to get in touch or not.
Correct. Yeah, that's exactly right.
I think that's crazy because a lot of founders sometimes also might not know that, like how well some funds really monitor the ecosystem, because it sometimes feels like an accident to get contacted by a fund and don't really know about the strategy behind and how they assess markets. And I would say in a perfect world, you're only investing in, you know the market, you say, okay, I want to invest or we want to invest in this market, and we now talk to the companies that we identify that are in there, and we just want to, like, in a perfect world, you only invest in the best of these, like, let's say, five companies that survive to growth stage. So it's but it also sounds like a very long race with a lot of other funds.
Yes. Yeah. I think you described all of that very well. You know, if you just think about a little bit the fact that we're doing growth stage, a little bit later stage investing, it would be a little, it happens, but it would be unusual for a company to just, like, sort of appear at a stage, you know, where they needed to raise the sort of funds that we're able to provide. Usually it's a company we know of, we've been watching them, they've raised a couple of early rounds, they're getting traction, their brand is known in the marketplace, they're in the news a little bit. Like, it's, you know, we're seeing these things typically as they're sort of coming up the curve before they, you know, get to the size that they'll need funding from GA. So I think you're exactly right. You described that well.
It's also interesting because as you already have numbers and data, it's so different from early stage fundraising, where you're like, okay, it's also about how much do the fund partners like me. And that's still the case. You have to have the feeling that you can work together in a great relationship. But it's not only based on what I say and the characteristics, but also what I did the last years. And I think a lot of founders don't understand that they are actually, even when it's a lot of trial and error, they have to try to build something that is worthwhile looking at 5, 6, 7 years from now, and not only for the next round. So a lot of founders are like, hey, how can I raise my seed? How can I raise my Series A, maybe Series B? But only look at the milestones they seem to have, that they have to hit to get the next funding round, instead of what would a great company look like that is interesting to any investor also down the road, and how can I try to build it as close to that as possible today already?
Yeah, I couldn't have said it better. I think that's exactly right, the right way to think about it. And, you know, that's very much, you know, like if I think about diligence for us, once we, you know, hear the pitch and have the first meeting and get beyond, let's say, the first hour, then the next whole series of conversations that we want to have at GA are really just to learn about the business, learn about the customers, how do they go to market, how do they build their product, what's the financial performance of the business. So, you know, for us, it's really almost entirely about what is the business you've built and how do you, you know, intend to grow that, scale that going forward. So, yeah, I think that's very much true. It's to your point, in the early stages, it's a lot about, let's say, the vision and the slides and, you know, the charisma of the, you know, management team and so on. But those are only a small part of what we, you know, think about when we consider investment.
At the same time, I think we all have to admit that no company can be perfect. So how do you assess weaknesses of a venture, and how do you assess if they are something that you can build out to strengths throughout the next years, rather than saying, okay, that's a KO criteria that we can't invest in?
Yeah. Yeah. Look, I think you're right. Like, no business is perfect. We recognize that. And even if the businesses that we invest in, the trajectory of the business is not just a straight line up and to the right, you know, it's always a bumpy ride. Like, so we, you know, understand that. I would say probably the number one thing that is most important for us is finding a CEO and finding a management team that is sort of self-aware about these things. Like, they're a management team that can assess the business and be honest with themselves and be honest with us about what's working and what's not working. I think that's really the starting point. And companies that do that, leadership teams that do that, then we're happy to engage with them and work with them and help them grow and improve and, you know, change the business going forward. As you heard me mention a few minutes ago, we have a lot of tools in our toolbox to help with that. If they're having, you know, challenges scaling their sales team, or they're having scalability problems in the product, or, you know, these types of problems are common. We see it often, and we have good resources that can help companies, you know, navigate those things going forward. I think the real problem comes when an entrepreneur or a management team doesn't see the problems or won't admit the problems, or in some ways is, let's say, kind of pushing us away from helping in those cases. And that's really problematic. You know, those are cases that become a lot more challenging to try and get alignment with management about how we can help. But yeah, no doubt, every business has challenges. That's part of, let's say, the fun of growth equity investing is, you know, helping companies grow and scale. It's kind of why we're here to do that.
So to sum it up, no matter how great the business looks, it ultimately comes down to the trustworthiness and the character of the founders and management team and leadership team that wants to bring it through to the success case it should be.
Yeah. That's right. It's about an entrepreneur, a CEO, and a management team that wants to build a great business. You know, they want to build a business that, you know, serves customers well and treats employees with respect, and at the same time generates economic value. I think those are the things that, you know, are really the most core issues for the business.
Do you have any tips for, and I think that's my last question already, but do you have any tips for founders who are currently more in the earlier stages but want to prepare for a growth round soonish, I would say?
Yeah, I would offer up maybe two pieces of advice, and I think both of these will tie in nicely to what we've discussed. The first piece of advice is when you're getting ready for your growth round, I would say, let's say, get your own house in order, you know, as preparation for that. The growth investor, it's easy to have the first meeting. As I said, our front door is wide open. But as you get to know the growth investor, they're going to start asking a lot of questions about performance, about customers, about sales effectiveness, about economics, about the product and its architecture, and so on. And I think the more prepared and thoughtful a company can be for those questions, just the more smoothly that process will go. Most companies are pretty prepared for that, but we occasionally see companies, when we start asking those questions, really having trouble pulling the data together, or they don't have somebody who could answer certain questions and so on. And those are things that will derail a conversation, you know, that should be happening. So I think my kind of first piece of advice is, as you get ready to raise growth fundraising, sort of get, you know, prepared a little bit, let's say, for some of those questions. The second thing I would say is maybe turning it around a little bit. If I were in entrepreneur's shoes, one of the things I would want to do is I would want to evaluate the partner. I would want to think about General Atlantic or other firms that you would be raising capital from and really be thoughtful about, can they help me grow and scale my business? You know, not just are they people I want to work with, but are they people who can really bring experience, bring tools, bring connections, of course, bring capital, but also bring the other things that I need for me to help grow and scale my business. It's very much a two-way street. And I think sometimes entrepreneurs don't, let's say, kind of realize that, you know, like that runs both ways, that like they have a choice and they get to pick who the partner is. And I would encourage them to just be very thoughtful and do their own homework about what the partner could bring to the table. So those might be the two things I would offer up.
Thank you so much. I think that's a very good summary of what we talked about and how to also have, as a founder, you have to think about, okay, who am I marrying, as you called it earlier. And I think you have to understand you're still on the journey for another 5 to 7 years often. Even longer sometimes, and sometimes a bit shorter, but mostly longer than shorter. And you have to be prepared, and you have to know what you want out of it, what you can bring to the table, how you can make it happen, what your commitment is to that. And you definitely need to think about that at least twice, if not more often, before you start reaching out, because otherwise people will understand that you're not as prepared as possible. Corey, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for all your time. I will link to your LinkedIn profile, to GA, to everything in the show notes. And everybody, if anyone has the feeling to want to reach out, you can also just ping me and I can forward it if it makes sense. So happy to do that. Corey, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure, Bobby. It's great to be on the Unicorn Bakery, and look forward to hearing some of the follow-up from your listeners. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.